Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, April 20th, 2023. Labor Secretary nominee Julie Sue testifies before a Senate committee. Her confirmation hearing, she defends her record the last 2 years as Deputy Labor Secretary and before that, leading California's Labor Department. But it's not certain she will have enough Democratic senators to vote for her to be confirmed if all Republican senators vote no. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin lending his support to Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy's proposal to package together a national debt ceiling increase with federal spending cuts, saying that President Biden's objection to negotiating the two together signals a deficiency of leadership. We'll get White House reaction. U.S. House passing a bill to bar transgender female athletes from competing in girls and women's sports. It was a party-line vote. Republicans yes, Democrats no. An IRS whistleblower claims an investigation of Hunter Biden, son of President Biden, has been mishandled and improperly influenced due to political considerations. And the U.S. military putting additional forces near Sudan in case the U.S. Embassy personnel there need to be evacuated from the capital Khartoum, where Sudan's army is fighting paramilitary rebels with gunfire and explosions in the streets. We begin with the Labor Secretary nominee Julie Sue. She's the current Deputy Secretary. Associated Press reports she won praise at her Senate hearing Thursday as a champion of the working class, even as key Democrats appeared unwilling to voice support, creating uncertainty about her confirmation prospects. Democratic Senators Joe Manchin, John Tester, and Mark Kelly, and Senator Kyrsten Sinema, an independent, all declined to say whether they would vote for her confirmation this week. Democrats cannot afford to lose more than a couple votes in the Senate, divided 51-49. And Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat from California, is also recovering from shingles in California with no firm return date. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, chairs the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, which held today's hearing. He supports Julie Sue's nomination. He's the one who called her a champion of the working class. And he asked her about some of the policies she would pursue if confirmed as secretary.
You mentioned that there are, in so many words, there are millions of young people who do not necessarily want to go to college, who are prepared to get their hands dirty, go out, earn good wages doing some of the important work that needs to be done to rebuild America. Talk a little bit about your vision of strong apprenticeship programs for our country.
So there's so much we can do there. Thank you so much, Chairman Sanders. And we've been doing it over the last 2 years at the Department of Labor. We have dramatically expanded apprenticeships across the country. We have, just in the last 2 years, over 4,600 new apprenticeship programs, representing 11,000 or so employers. These are opportunities to make sure not only that job seekers, and in particular young people, get the high-quality skills training that they need, but that employers who are looking for skilled workers to do the many things that we are doing right now, right? Rebuilding roads and bridges and ensuring broad internet accessibility to communities all across the country, making sure that every family that turns on the faucet gets clean drinking water out of it, building coast-to-coast electric vehicle charging stations, all of this work needs workers. And employers have been saying that, what are we going to do to make sure that we have the workers that we need? And apprenticeship programs are a big part of that answer. Our overall workforce development system is a big part of that answer. And my team has heard me say this at the Department of Labor many, many times. We can build physical roads and bridges. We also have to build the roads and bridges that connect people to the jobs they need. So that's what the system
is. What I'm hearing from you as Secretary of Labor, you're prepared to work with this committee to greatly expand apprenticeship programs in this country.
Senator Bernie Sanders, chair of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, questioning Labor Secretary nominee Julie Sue at today's hearing. More from the Associated Press article about the hearing. Julie Sue was previously confirmed as the Deputy Labor Secretary, but has faced opposition from business groups critical of her record leading California's Labor Department. They point to her support of an overturned California law that would have required app-based ride-hailing and delivery companies like Uber and Lyft, as well as trucking businesses, to treat their workers as employees, providing benefits like paid sick leave and unemployment insurance rather than independent contractors. Julie Sue has also faced blame for problems at the California Labor and Workforce Development Agency during the coronavirus pandemic, when unprecedented numbers of people applying for unemployment benefits faced long wait times and the state potentially paid out billions of dollars in fraudulent claims. Back to today's hearing, Senator Mitt Romney, Republican from Utah, asked Julie Sue about those unemployment benefits and the estimate that as much as $31 billion was obtained fraudulently.
The vast majority, over 95% of the fraud in the unemployment system, not just in California but across the nation, was in the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, a program that was passed by Congress to meet a very, very urgent need, an unprecedented crisis that was viewed to require an unprecedented solution. That Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program did not have the safeguards that regular unemployment insurance does.
You set those safeguards. There are guidelines in California you chose to waive to get that money out. $31 billion.
So, Senator,
you realize what $31 billion would have meant to the people in Ukraine? Have we been able to double our military support there?
Yes, yes. And that is why fraud, waste, and abuse of any kind is completely unacceptable. That is why in California, as soon as we knew that there was fraud happening, I shut the front door to that fraud. I made changes to the program that would ensure that people couldn't get in the front door. But to be very clear, the state auditor who did many audits never found that my eliminating eligibility requirements resulted in any of the pandemic unemployment system fraud that we're talking about.
My time is up. The buck stops at the top. You're the person running UI. You're the one that decided to waive the guardrails. $31 billion. The idea of promoting a person who's had that experience to a position of leadership of the entire Department of Labor makes no sense at all. Thank you.
Respectfully, Senator, if I may, just on the unemployment insurance fraud issue, California's unemployment insurance fraud rate, which was different from the pandemic unemployment assistance, was really about comparable to what it's been before. The high rates that you're talking about were in a program that did not have the safeguards in its design.
Julie Sue, nominated for Labor Secretary, questioned by Senator Mitt Romney, Republican from Utah, at today's Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee hearing. A committee vote on her nomination is scheduled for Wednesday, April 26th, 10 a.m. Eastern. If confirmed, Julie Sue would replace former Labor Secretary Marty Walsh, who resigned last month. Julie Sue has been acting Labor Secretary since then. Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, putting out a statement in support of House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California's proposal that would raise the national debt limit and cut federal spending. Senator Manchin writing, "We are long past time for our elected leaders to sit down and discuss how to solve this impending debt ceiling crisis. Our elected leaders must stop with the political games, work together, and negotiate a compromise. Instead, it has been more than 78 days since President Biden last met with Speaker McCarthy. This signals a deficiency of leadership, and it must change." Part of the statement from Senator Manchin. Question about it today to the White House Press Secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre.
Senator Joe Manchin is calling on the president to negotiate with Speaker McCarthy, accusing him of a deficiency of leadership. What is your response to those comments from Senator Manchin? And is your point that the president's unwillingness to negotiate becomes unsustainable?
So, as you know, we have a strong and productive relationship with Senator Manchin. He's someone that the president has been able to pass some historic pieces of legislation because of the help of Senator Manchin. So, again, they have a strong relationship. The president's message is pretty simple. It has been very simple this past several weeks, several months. The way to have a real negotiation on the budget is for House Republicans to take threats of default when it comes to the economy and what it could potentially do to the economy off the table. We've been very clear about that. He's put forward his budget. The president has said, "Here's my budget." He was very clear. He showed his values. His budget is going to decrease the deficit by an additional $3 billion over the next 10 years. It's going to make sure that we invest in Americans, that we lower cost. So the president has said, "Here's what I'm going to do." And not only that, make sure that the super wealthy are paying their share. And so the president and Senator Manchin agreed we must avoid default. And just as President Reagan said, and just as President Trump said, that when they were in office, we have to avoid default. That means House Republicans need to get to work and stop the delay and put a bill on the floor that's going to avoid default.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre taking reporters' questions in the White House briefing room. The House Republican bill, which was just introduced, expected to get a vote on the House floor next week would increase the national debt limit by $1.5 trillion to avoid an otherwise expected default later this year. That $1.5 trillion expected to last at least another year until the ceiling is hit. The bill would also cut federal spending by an estimated $4.5 trillion over 10 years by capping discretionary federal spending at fiscal 2022 levels, canceling the president's student loan debt relief plan, reversing parts of the Democrats' Inflation Reduction Act, and some other items. Speaker Kevin McCarthy asked today if he expects it will pass the House.
The debt ceiling, if you don't mind,
yes.
Do you have the votes for next week? Do you have the votes to pass it?
I think we're in very good shape. We just rolled it out yesterday. We're working, talking through all the members, and I don't want to break all expectations. I want you to follow it. I want you to be on the floor. I want the anticipation. I want you to see. I want you to see as the clock goes up. I want you to write stories like I'm teetering whether I could win or not, and the whole world hangs in the balance. And then I want you to write a story after it passes. Would the president sit down and negotiate? Just like we've done every other time before. Would the Senate, are they going to take up another bill to name the next month maple syrup? Are they going to honor the UConn team that they won a basketball tournament? Or will they sit down and work for the American people? I mean, I don't know what the month of May will be about in the Senate or what they'll honor, but I think they ought to honor the American public and actually take up a debt ceiling.
Mr. Speaker,
yes.
To follow up on this point, with the current makeup of the Senate, are you concerned at all that we'll be back in the same position come June if the House passes this and sends it over to the Senate?
You know, someone asked me that question when we were trying to defend everybody's safety here in D.C. We put a bill on the floor to stop them from decriminalizing everything. You know what? It passed the Senate and the president signed it. Same thing happened with about the pandemic. So I shouldn't have to worry about the Senate. I'm just worried about the Senate actually working. I'm just worried about the Senate actually showing up. But if they show up, is it going to be another month naming Maine the maple syrup for March? Is it going to be another month like this week where they named UConn basketball, honoring them for winning? Or will it take up the issues that America cares most about? They've got inflation going because the Democrats added $6 trillion. Every poll will show you Americans do not want you just to lift the debt ceiling and continue to have inflation. They want us to be less dependent upon China. So they want us to pass exact bill what we're doing. They want us to be able to protect Social Security and Medicare. So when we do work requirements, it helps more people go to work, more people to pay in. That's the concern they have. Now, I can't worry about the Senate. I worry about the Senate leader and Schumer, what he can do or accomplish, because he hasn't shown that he's done much. I just wish he sits down and be able to do something. So that's why I talked to the president. I don't understand. He's the first president in the country that can bumble his way into a default, or should he sit down and negotiate like everybody's done before?
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, taking reporters' questions at a news conference today on Capitol Hill. The bipartisan House Problem Solvers Caucus has put out its own plan to prevent a default on the U.S. debt if no other compromise is reached. An article at Axios explains that the plan includes suspending the debt ceiling and creating an independent commission modeled after the Pentagon panel to determine which military bases to close to recommend a package to stabilize the debt and deficit, which would be voted on by Congress. The co-chairs of the caucus are Brian Fitzpatrick, Republican from Pennsylvania, and Josh Gottheimer, Democrat from New Jersey. They were interviewed today by Punchbowl News founder Jake Sherman.
One thing that is that would surprise me, and this is both of you, I think, play a part in this in some respect. A lot of people thought for a long time that someone in Congress should introduce in January, should have introduced a clean debt ceiling bill, and then file a discharge petition to get it out of committee. Neither of you did that. Even as a fail-safe, a discharge petition requires 218 signatures. You would have gotten there between some of the, there's a couple people in your party who would be for that as a fail-safe. Why didn't you do that? You were giving McCarthy time to negotiate, but I mean, retrospectively, was that a good idea?
Because a clean debt ceiling just further kicks the can down the road. It starts with, everybody's got to decide where they fall on these two things. You either believe it or you don't. That we have two, not one, but two simultaneous problems. We are at a fiscal cliff at risk of default. You either believe that that's unacceptable or you don't. I believe it's unacceptable. I think most people do. Not everybody, most people. Second is that we have a debt to GDP ratio that exceeds 100%. That's happened two times in our nation's history, World War II and today. You either believe that's a problem or you don't. And if we're not attacking both problems, then we are acting in a manner that's unbecoming of our responsibilities. Now, the way I wish we would have proceeded is knowing how this is going to end. We know how it's going to end. It's going to be a two-party solution done at the last minute, right? Is it fair to say that that's what's going to happen?
Probably,
yes. You have a 4-vote Republican margin in the House. You have a 2-vote Democrat margin in the Senate. You have a 60-vote filibuster threshold with a Democrat president. So anything that gets done, and we know something has to get done, we're not going to allow our markets to spiral. We're not going to allow that to happen. Anything that happens is going to be a two-party solution. So why not start now on that? And a clean debt ceiling, that's a one-party solution. That's not a two-party solution.
But Mr. Gottheimer, you're probably not, are you, let me ask you, are you comfortable with a clean debt ceiling?
If that came up,
yeah.
Of course I'd support it.
Yeah.
The question is, could you actually get it, could you get it passed out of the House? Could you get it passed out of the Senate? Could it become law? And part of the challenge was just purely parliamentary in terms of what level you'd be at, and right?
That's right.
And there were some real questions about a discharge, which is why I think our leadership was saying, why there was actually concerns, because you didn't know what level would be. So you're discharging something, and then that would, remember, it discharges back to the committee, right? So then the committee could mark something up. It's not, it wasn't necessarily, my understanding, an actual fail-safe that would work. Right. And so part of this is, can we come up with something that actually would work, that both sides give a little bit on, both sides can come to the table. And I think what Brian and I and a lot of us feel is like people actually have to get to the table and talk. And that's very important. Even if you don't agree on everything on day one.
Well, Biden's saying he doesn't want to do that.
You keep working. Right. And but maybe he will now that they've made a proposal. Maybe they will. But I think it's important that we talk. And it's always that engagement is critical.
Josh Gottheimer, Democrat from New Jersey, and before that, Brian Fitzpatrick, Republican from Pennsylvania, the co-chairs of the U.S. House Problem Solvers Caucus, which has about 30 Democrats and 30 Republicans as members. They were at a program today hosted by Punch Bowl News. Find the full audio and video at our website, cspan.org. Wall Street today, the Dow down 110, NASDAQ down 97, S&P down 24. President Joe Biden announcing plans to double U.S. funding to help developing countries fight climate change to a total of $1 billion. President speaking virtually this morning to the Major Economies Forum on Energy and Climate.
All of you know as well as I do, the impacts of climate change will be felt the most by those who've contributed the least to the problem, including developing nations. As large economies and large emitters, we must step up and support these economies. So today, I'm pleased to announce the United States is going to provide $1 billion to the Green Climate Fund, a fund that is critical in ways to help developing nations that they can't do now. But it should not be the only way. Together, we need to strengthen the role of multilateral development banks in fighting climate crisis as well, starting with the World Bank. Because climate security, energy security, food security, they're all related.
President Biden this morning in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building next to the White House, a virtual meeting with the leaders taking part in the Major Economies Forum on Energy and Climate. And that includes Argentina, Australia, Canada, Chile, China, Egypt, the European Commission, France, Germany, India, Indonesia, Italy, Japan, South Korea, Mexico, Nigeria, Norway, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, United Arab Emirates, the United Kingdom, and Vietnam. President Biden also announcing that he'll request $500 million over 5 years to contribute to the Amazon Fund, which works to combat deforestation of the Amazon forest in Brazil. President Biden has set a goal of reducing U.S. greenhouse gas emissions by 50% by the year 2030 compared to 2005 levels. And to help achieve that, the administration just recently proposed new stricter vehicle tailpipe emission standards that could result, some people estimate, in about 2/3 of all new vehicles sold in the U.S. by 2032 being electric vehicles. The Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm was questioned about this today by Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming, ranking Republican on the Environment and Public Works Committee.
The department is right in the middle of the EPA's attempt to regulate the internal combustion engine out of existence. The administration won't stop until everything's electrified. We'll then be more dependent on China and Russia for materials that go into batteries and solar panels and wind turbines. So do you think electric vehicles really are the right choice for every driver? And why is the Biden administration trying to ban cars and trucks the people of Wyoming need to drive to go from point A to point B in our large state?
The administration is not trying to ban anything. The administration, through the EPA, is trying to reduce emissions. And the emissions can be best reduced through electrification. That might be through a battery electrification. That might be through fuel cell. But there is not any effort to ban vehicles, internal combustion engine vehicles. We do know that's the largest source, of course, of greenhouse gas emissions, providing 30% of the source of emissions. And we all, I think everyone agrees that we need to, as a nation, continue to move toward efficiency. And that rule will do this.
Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm, questioned by Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming, ranking Republican on the Environment and Public Works Committee at today's hearing, looking at the fiscal year 2024 budget request for the Energy Department. Story at the Washington Post, 42,795 people were killed in traffic crashes last year, according to an estimate Thursday from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, a sign that a pandemic-era surge in deaths has been slowed but not reversed. The estimate represents a decline of 0.3% compared with 2021, but an increase of almost 18% compared with 2019. The Transportation Department launched a national roadway safety strategy that has billions in additional funding for safety measures under the bipartisan infrastructure law, but the data suggests those efforts have yet to bear fruit. That from the Washington Post. The Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg testified today about the fiscal year 2024 transportation budget before the House Appropriations Subcommittee that handles that budget. Congressman John Rutherford, Republican from Florida, asking him about a specific type of accident called a front over, when a driver moving forward slowly in a parking lot or driveway hits someone, often a child.
These front over accidents, I've heard from concerned constituents in my district, and I'm sure every district across America. These front overs are usually accidents that occur at a very low speed, usually in parking lots, driveways, and they always involve pedestrians. It's my understanding that NHTSA reports on non-traffic accidents such as these that occur in driveways, parking lots, or private roads. In their non-traffic report from 2016 to 2020, they noted that 386 pedestrians are killed every year by a forward-moving vehicle in a non-traffic setting. And that's concerning. I know there's some efforts out there that the vehicle manufacturers can take. Is the Department of Transportation working with the auto industry at all on technology that could reduce the occurrence of these front-overs? And would DOT benefit from collecting additional information on this from these non-traffic accidents, such as their setting and what causes them? Mm-hmm. You know, you see some of these new trucks, they sit so high. Right. Small child sitting in front of that vehicle, they get in from the back. The driver gets in from the back, doesn't see the child, runs right over them. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, and thanks for the chance to address this safety concern. It's something that is mounting, especially as the typical privately owned vehicle gets larger across America. We need to make sure that each passing year our vehicles are safer than they used to be. I would point to two lines of effort that I think are responsive to the concern you're raising. One has to do with continued data research and rulemaking on technologies like automatic AEB and the braking that goes with that, and just the visibility that can be created through sensors, cameras, and other technology. Often they first arrive in the fleet as relatively new and sometimes even untested technology, but quickly can be demonstrated to be something that's got such life-saving potential that it ought to be made a requirement so that whether you have access to it doesn't depend on whether you can afford that particular bell or whistle because it's standard. The second thing I would point to is a shift in how we're thinking about the new car assessment program. Traditionally, it was confined to the safety of the occupants. And, of course, we're very concerned about the safety of the occupants of a vehicle. That's why seatbelts, airbags, and a whole lot more is evaluated. We've reached the point where we also need to be paying attention to how the design of a vehicle has implications for the safety of those who are outside of it. And that's something that you will see more of, I think, in the years to come as NHTSA develops its next steps for the NCAP program.
All right. Thank you very much. And I'll be interested in following that. Having worked the backups before we had the backup cameras, remember that?
Congressman John Rutherford, Republican from Florida, questioning the Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg at today's House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing about the fiscal year 2024 budget request for the Transportation Department. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now mobile app and wherever you get your podcasts. U.S. House today passing a bill to prohibit transgender athletes at schools that get federal funding from competing in girls and women's sports. The bill would change the definition of sex in Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972 to, quote, based solely on a person's reproductive biology and genetics at birth. Ahead of the House floor vote, a group of female Republican members of Congress holding a news conference, including Beth Van Dyne of Texas.
Just this past weekend, the Lady Mustangs soccer team of Grapevine High School in North Texas won their school's very first state championship. The Lady Mustangs soccer team made history for their school, and we could not be more proud of them in the 24th Congressional District. Their team is made up entirely of biological girls, just as it should be. And the team they played in the championship match is also made up entirely of biological girls, just as it should be. We celebrate both teams, the training, the long hours, the hard work that all of these girls put into being able to compete at their very best and at the highest level. And this is exactly what we want to protect. Biological girls being able to fairly compete against other biological girls in the sports they love. That we must be even talking about passing the Protection of Women and Girls in Sports Act shows how stark, raving mad leftists have perverted what should be a very simple subject. Biological women and girls should only be competing against other biological women and girls. And I don't care how many surgeries you have, I don't care how many chemicals you put into your body, you're not going to be a biological woman. Anyone who claims to be a feminist or believe in what feminism was founded upon should proudly stand with us and vote for this bill to protect and preserve women's sports for real biological women and girls.
Congresswoman Beth Van Dyne, Republican from Texas, at a news conference this morning right before the House passed this bill to prevent female transgender athletes from taking part in girls and women's sports. Washington Post reporting on it writes, during the floor debate Thursday, Republicans adopted an amendment from Congressman Andrew Ogles, Republican of Tennessee, that would protect public schools that follow the bill's instruction from possible lawsuits accusing them of discrimination or harassment. An amendment from Congresswoman Nancy Mace, Republican from South Carolina, that would study the adverse effects of allowing transgender women to participate in women's sports and the psychological effects on cisgender women and girls, also was adopted. That study would then be delivered to Congress. The final vote in the House was 219-203, and it was strictly party line. The Republicans voting yes, the Democrats voting no. The House Democratic leader, Hakeem Jeffries of New York, talking about the bill at his news conference following the vote.
The extreme MAGA Republicans are trying to sensationalize an issue that doesn't really exist in the way that they are falsely portraying. If this is about elite sports competition, let's allow the relevant organizations involved in elite sports competition to do what they do and to set the framework and the boundaries and the rules of engagement. And you know what? Many of them already have. The NCAA already has a policy as it relates to this issue. So does the International Olympic Committee. So does the Track and Field Association. And many high school athletic associations have this issue addressed. So what this is about, again, extreme MAGA Republicans doing everything possible to jam their right-wing ideology down the throats of the American people. And it continues to happen. It's happened with abortion care, happening with banning books about our history, and now they want to bully kids, transgender kids. By the way, more than 50% of transgender children have either contemplated suicide or attempted suicide. Where is the decency on the other side of the aisle that in the face of that dynamic, you want to bully trans kids and create an issue because you think it's politically going to benefit you? I believe it will not.
Congressman Akeem Jeffries, Democrat from New York, the minority leader, at a news conference today before passage of this bill, officially titled Protection of Women and Girls in Sports Act, now heads to the Senate. President Biden has issued a veto threat against it. NBC News reports the Biden administration weighed in this month by proposing new regulations that would prohibit categorical bans on trans athletes at schools receiving federal funding, but allow some restrictions at more elite levels of competition. The proposal summary says the rules should take into account differences in age, grade, and level of competition. Senator Patty Murray, Democrat from Washington State, hitting a milestone today, casting her 10,000th vote. She is the 33rd U.S. Senator in U.S. history to reach that number and the first female senator to do so. Some celebrations on the Senate floor with the Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, and Republican Senator Susan Collins.
It's a great moment because, or a few moments ago was a great moment, but it continues to be. Our dear friend, Senator Patty Murray, reached an amazing milestone, 10,000 votes over the course of her career in the Senate. The first woman senator in American history to do so. You're not supposed to clap, but every once in a while, breaking protocol is appropriate, as it is now. So it's a remarkable accomplishment for a truly remarkable public servant. Her accomplishments go, if she just cast 10,000 votes, that would be pretty good, but her accomplishments go way beyond that and often dwarf it. She was also the first woman to serve in several Senate leadership positions, chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee, chair of the Budget Committee, and of course, at the beginning of this Congress, she made history as the first woman ever to serve as president pro tem of the Senate. She's a voice the Senate, the country, rely on some of the biggest issues we face. When she speaks, everyone listens, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives, independents, because they know that she has studied it carefully and it comes right from the heart. It's not political calculation in any way. So in issues like health care, environment, labor rights, pension, child care, there is Patty Murray as a beacon, not just a speaker, not just a legislator, but a beacon to all of us. And let me tell you, she's been such a valued member of my leadership team through the years, where she did so, so much, and I relied on her for advice, 202-374-35, and I won't say the last two numbers. I know her phone number by heart, because I call her so much. Didn't do the rest, don't worry. Maybe we should delete that from the record. I ask unanimous consent to delete all those numbers from the record.
Without objection.
Let's take a moment to recognize and congratulate this great person, this great woman, this great senator, this great friend, this great member of the United States Senate, Senator Patty Murray. Thank you.
Republican leader.
Mr. President, if I may say to our colleague from Washington, I remember, as you certainly did, that 1992 was declared the year of the woman, and a number of women were elected to the Senate, but you were the leader of the group, and you've had an extraordinarily successful career, and I wanted you to know that people on both sides of the aisle admire your service, and congratulations.
Mr. President.
Senator from Maine.
Mr. President, I just want to add my congratulations to my friend and colleague, Senator Murray, for casting her 10,000th vote. She has been such a remarkable leader, a steady force, a hard worker, and it has been wonderful to work in partnership with her on the Appropriations Committee. Patty, congratulations, and we look forward to many more extraordinary accomplishments.
Senator Susan Collins, Republican from Maine. Before that, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky. And before that, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, congratulating Senator Murray on reaching that 10,000th vote. Of the 32 other senators in U.S. history that have cast more than 10,000 votes, two are still in the Senate, Mitch McConnell with almost 12,800, and Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa, with nearly 14,500. Number one on the list all time is Senator Robert Byrd, Democrat from West Virginia, 18,689. And by the way, Joe Biden, President Joe Biden, is number 14, 12,810. The Senate today passed legislation that would reauthorize federal programs providing local fire department grants for training, equipment, and staffing. The vote was 95-2. Two Republicans voted no, Mike Lee of Utah and Rand Paul of Kentucky. Some reaction today to the attorney for an IRS whistleblower who says his client has information about mishandling and political interference in a high-profile criminal investigation. And several news sites adding the investigation is about Hunter Biden, President Biden's son. Congressman Mike Lawler, Republican from New York, was interviewed on Fox News this morning.
The fact that you have a senior IRS official stepping forward and saying that a investigation, and again, we don't know exactly what it is, but a investigation has been interfered with, and that it that there is facts and evidence that contradict sworn testimony before Congress, is a five-alarm fire when it comes to any potential investigation and the politicization of these agencies. And so that's something where I think the American people should want to get to the bottom of this. We, as a House Republican majority, have an obligation to provide oversight and investigation. And that is what's going to happen here. And so this whistleblower should be afforded every protection to come forward and present the facts and the evidence. And then let Congress and the American people decide what is there.
Congressman Mike Lawler, Republican from New York, on Fox News this morning. A White House spokesperson, Ian Sams, putting out a statement that reads, since he took office and consistent with his campaign promise that he would restore the independence of the Justice Department when it comes to decision-making in criminal investigations, President Biden has made clear that this matter would be handled independently by the Justice Department, under the leadership of a U.S. attorney appointed by former President Donald Trump, free from any political interference by the White House. He has upheld that commitment. More from the White House briefing today with the press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre.
Does the White House support giving this IRS agent whistleblower protection?
For the state of transparency and so that we do not politicize any of this, the president has been very clear that this is something for the Department of Justice, which is independent, and we have been very clear since the campaign that this is something that they need to speak to, and that's why we refer you to the Department of Justice. We're just not going to speak about it from here.
Can I just have you respond to some Republicans, though, who suggest that the fact that the IRS agent is seeking whistleblower status could show that the administration is slow walking or somehow obstructing justice?
We're letting Department of Justice handle this. That's what an administration does when they believe in the rule of law, when they believe that the Department of Justice is independent. That's what the president believes. This is something for the Department of Justice. This is an issue that they're dealing with, and we leave that to them. As I mentioned, my White House colleagues at the counsel's office put out a statement on this. They were more specific on that, and so I certainly would refer you to my colleagues and to the Department of Justice.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre at her news conference. A story from NBC News, federal prosecutors have been investigating Hunter Biden's taxes since 2018 before his father was elected president. Hunter Biden's attorney said Thursday that the IRS whistleblower could be improperly disclosing private tax information and attempting to abuse the power of the government to harm the president's son. This is Washington Today. The Pentagon says it's moving additional capabilities to the region near Sudan to prepare for a possible evacuation of U.S. embassy personnel from Sudan, which is currently in the middle of a civil war. Associated Press writes that planning got underway in earnest on Monday after a U.S. embassy convoy was attacked in Khartoum, the Sudanese capital. The National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby joined Karine Jean-Pierre at the White House briefing and asked about this.
I want to start off by asking you about Sudan, the decision to send U.S. troops there. Can you update us on the status of the embassy and trying to get U.S. officials out of the embassy?
Yeah, so obviously we're still very concerned about the violence there, the continued fighting. There was a so-called ceasefire last night that didn't hold very long, and so people are still being hurt. What I can tell you is that we have good accountability of all our government personnel there working in and out of the embassy. They are all not still co-located, so the State Department is still, the embassy there is still trying to get them all co-located together for their own safety. They are still sheltering in place where they are. And as you probably saw, the Pentagon did announce that they are moving forward to pre-position some military forces and capabilities nearby, just for contingency purposes, in case they would be needed for any kind of evacuation. But again, no decision has been made on that. The focus right now is on urging both sides to stop this violence, to abide by a ceasefire, to allow humanitarian aid to get to people that need it. I mean, there's already shortages of food. There's concern over shortages of medicine and water. The situation is dire in Khartoum, and we continue to urge both sides now to stop this violence.
What is the timeline for making a final decision, and are sanctions on the table against these rival factions?
I won't get ahead of any sanctions decisions. I mean, we'll always look at a range of tools and capabilities that we have to try to compel both sides here to stop this violence. As for timeline, I think I'd refer you to the Department of Defense and the State Department on that. They would have to work in tandem here. But we want to make sure that we've got the capability ready in case it's needed. And again, DOD can speak to the timeline on that.
John Kirby, Strategic Communications Coordinator for the National Security Council, today in the White House briefing room. Associated Press reports the additional U.S. troops and equipment are being pre-positioned at a naval base in the Gulf of Aden nation of Djibouti, prepare for the possible evacuation of about 70 U.S. embassy personnel from Sudan's capital city. The Hymn of the Partisans, the unofficial anthem of Holocaust survivors, sung today at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum's Days of Remembrance ceremony held in the U.S. Capitol building in Washington. The annual commemoration of the Holocaust and the murder of 6 million Jews and several million others by the Nazi regime during World War II. The keynote speech today given by Deborah Lipstadt, the State Department's special envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism.
I'm often asked what my goal is for my tenure in office. Well, I certainly hope to be able to reduce the proliferation of the expressions of anti-Semitism. I also hope to enhance the world's understanding that the fight against anti-Semitism is not a niche issue. It's about far more than protecting Jews, although if it were just that, it would be sufficient, for it is a fundamental obligation of a government to keep its citizens safe, especially the most vulnerable among them. But anti-Semitism is much more than an attack on Jews. It is an attack on democracy. The anti-Semite believes that Jews have an all-controlling power over every aspect of government and society. The anti-Semite believes democracy is a sham. In any country where anti-Semitism is left free to range, democracy is at stake. Freedom is at risk. Security is at risk. Stability is at risk. The doubts the National Socialists, the Nazis, sowed about Weimar democracy and the way it was a nefarious conspiracy of the Jews helped bring it down and slowly led to the ultimate horror of the Holocaust. That is why President Biden, Vice President Harris, Secretary Blinken, and governors and lawmakers from both sides of the aisle rightfully consider anti-Semitism not just a threat to a particular group of Americans, but also a threat to democracy and international security.
Deborah Lipstadt, State Department's special envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism, on Capitol Hill at the Days of Remembrance ceremony organized by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. International Holocaust Remembrance Day was Tuesday, the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, and the time between that day and the Sunday that follows are the Days of Remembrance in the United States. From CNN, SpaceX's Starship, the most powerful rocket ever built, took off from a launch pad on the coast of South Texas on Thursday at 9:28 a.m. Eastern, but exploded midair before stage separation. Thursday's launch marked the vehicle's historic first test flight. SpaceX tweeted, "As if the flight test was not exciting enough, Starship experienced a rapid, unscheduled disassembly before stage separation." Here's some of the play-by-play commentary from SpaceX.
As of right now, we are awaiting stage separation, where Starship should separate from the Super Heavy booster.
Yeah, Kate, right now it looks like we saw the start of the flip, but obviously we're seeing from the ground cameras the entire Starship stack continuing to rotate. We should have had separation by now. Obviously, this is does not appear to be a nominal situation.
Yeah, it does appear to be spinning, but I do want to remind everyone that everything after clearing the tower was icing on the cake.
This far into the test flight, the first integrated flight of the booster and the Starship vehicle.
Some audio from SpaceX on today's test flight of the company's Super Heavy rocket booster with its 33 engines lifting off from Starbase in Boca Chica, Texas, before exploding 4 minutes into the flight, 24 miles up. NASA Administrator Bill Nelson tweeting, "Every great achievement throughout history has demanded some level of calculated risk, because with great risk comes great reward. Looking forward to all that SpaceX learns to the next flight test and beyond." Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. Subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.